Corolla Digital. From Level 5 City in Glendale, it's This Week with Larry Miller. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, and everyone who loves spending Sundays away. Hi, folks, and welcome back to This Week with Larry Miller. I'm Larry Miller, but in a way, aren't we all? And that song never feels to make me smile. They get better every week. Of course, that's the Barry Bowman Orchestra and the Josephine Mucciolo Dancers, featuring boy tenor Philip Coley, asking the musical question, if Casey was really that good, why not walk him? They had first base open. Well said, well asked. And going in reverse order, Philip Coley wrote, because we read, I read Casey at the Bat last week or the week before. Colonel just held up the V for Victory 2 fingers 2 weeks before. And Casey at the Bat is a great poem. It's just wonderful. And Philip wrote in, it's a great question to find off that. If Casey was really that good, why not walk him? They had first base open. Well, that's a pretty good question. Now, a couple of reasons, you know, why not just walk him? First of all, well, there'd be no poem. I mean, there's not a great poem to write about. And then he slipped, and that one got away, and it kind of bounced on the plate, so they walked him. And that's the end of the poem? So that the poem is now called Casey Walked to First, and now there was man on first and third. And what happened? Well, you got to write another poem now to find out what happened in the game. But it's a very good question. And you know what? It never entered my head all these years of knowing Casey at the Bat. Somehow, even though it was written supposed to be, what, 1890, 1900 in baseball, in American baseball. And, you know, you just don't expect anything like that. Walk him. And another reason, by the way, they didn't walk him was, as I said to the colonel, well, you know, they did get him out. I mean, it's not as though he was Paul Bunyan. And that's what makes, of course, a great baseball player, the fact that even the greatest of all time, the greatest, you know, hitters, the greatest home run, you know, Babe Ruth, oh, good Lord, Ted Williams, I mean, not to start even thinking about the greatest ball players of all time, well, they don't get a hit every time. Babe Ruth, by the way, I loved reading this about him. Babe Ruth once said that he could have batted 700 if he just wanted to get any kind of a hit, if he just wanted to swing at the ball and get singles and doubles too. But his response to that was, but I don't want to get singles and doubles. Oh, okay. I mean, that's kind of a great attitude if you think about it. What did he like to do? He liked to do what he did. Stay out all night drinking, and then hit home runs. And how many people can say that? Actually, just one. Just Babe Ruth. But at any rate, though, I mean, it's wonderful to think about a great poem like Casey at the Bat, and then Philip saw through the end, well, why don't they just walk him? Well, but you know what? I'd rather have that great, great poem that also tells a story not only about life in general, but life in America, but also tells a story about what baseball players are and what they do. A baseball player can't get what he wants every single time. Now, what did Casey want to do right there? Well, he wanted to win the game for his team, and he wanted to hit that ball out of the park. And he was loved by the fans. He was loved by everyone in baseball, and he loved being in that moment and getting up there and then really stealing himself. And he sets his feet and he puts that back bat and he taps the plate and then he puts it back. And here we go, he says, here we go. And, well, it didn't happen. Mighty Casey has struck out. But, boy, that's a heck of a story. That poem brings you into that story. And I guess my answer to, if Casey was really that good, why not walk him? I guess my answer is, boy, I sure am glad they didn't, and I sure am glad we have that poem. And I'm sure I'm glad that's what that author thought, that we can make drama out of that moment and then compare it to life all over the country at the same time. So anyway, that's not a bad reason. And by the way, Josephine Mucciolo, who has the dancers this week, when Colonel Jeff said that name to me, I said, you know what? That's a great dancer's name. It's just great. Natural names are always great. Natural names sound real and sound great. Whenever, in any script I've ever written, I always go to names of friends from school because they're real names. If you make up a name, it always sounds made up. No matter what you do, it sounds made up. If you just say, and I'm just making this up, Frank Hessman, you know, now that could be a name, but part of your head says, that doesn't sound real. It sounds like the guy just made it up. But if you do this now, too, if you just think of two or three friends of yours from school, high school or college, it doesn't matter. And if you just say those names out loud, take a minute now. No, but really, you know, if you just say the names out loud, you'll realize those sound like what they are. They're real names of real people. And there's no better name for a character than a real person, even if the name isn't known. So in any case, I was glad to hear the colonel say, Josephine Mucciolo. And the reason we put Barry Bowman in the orchestra is it was Barry Bowman who found that great poem for us we read last week by Robert W. Service, right? And that was called The Cremation of Sam McGee. And it's a terrific poem. And Service was a wonderful poet. And the colonel said at that point last week, gee, I can't remember who sent it in. I'll have to find it. And he always does what he says he's going to do. And this week, when I walked in to say hi, walked into the studio here, he said, I found out who sent that poem. It's Barry Bowman. So that's why, folks, three good reasons why we had the Barry Bowman Orchestra and the Josephine Mucciolo Dancers featuring boy tenor Philip Coley asking the musical question, if Casey was really that good, why not just walk him? They had first base open. That's exactly true. It's a good find. It's a smart question from Philip Coley, but I sure am glad we have that poem instead. And by Amazon. That's right, Amazon. That's right, Amazon. Amazon is a sponsor of ours, and we always love that Amazon is a sponsor of ours because anything in the world you want, you get with Amazon. Anything you can think of, with the exception, of course, of an actual Amazon, if you ever get one of those, as I'm fond of saying, and it's very important, if you ever order something and it's delivered by an actual Amazon, a tall, muscular, gorgeous, sexual woman who is thrilled to be out of the Amazon, by the way. She's thrilled to be bringing a parcel to you in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. So if you get together with Amazon, if you say, would you like to come in? Do you like coffee? Would you like some donuts? And if you actually begin to see and smile at each other and sort of to communicate, please call us here at the studio first. Call Colonel Jeff and Dr. Chris and me, and we will come out immediately and take the Amazon off your hands, so to speak. And this is only in the interests of science, just to make sure she's okay for you after us. So at any rate, though, what you do is, do you call Amazon to get anything in the world you want? No, you don't. You don't. You never do. Never, ever go to Amazon on the internet. What you do is you go to us on the internet. You go to our website at LarryMillerPodcast.com. That's LarryMillerPodcast.com. I still have to look through the window whenever I say the website because I'm still not exactly sure to get the two heads nodding and smiling. Yes, you got it. LarryMillerPodcast.com, and there's a banner there that says Amazon. Click that banner. It will take you immediately to Amazon, to the same Amazon, to every Amazon, and you can get anything in the world you want. But once you click it on our website, we get part of that money. We get 2 cents for every $1 billion you send. No, they're very gracious to us, and so I think it's good for them, good business for them, and we make a couple of bucks here to keep the lights on, as we like to say. And so please do that with Amazon. And while you're there, click the banner that says PayPal. That's right, PayPal. It's fun to say that, more than I thought it would be over the weeks. PayPal. PayPal is a, there's a game we have on it. Well, it's not much of a game, I guess. It's really, in fact, it's no game at all. But what we'd like you to do is go to a local bar you like in your area and find out how much a drink costs there, because since you've never been to the bar, you don't know. How would you know? How are you going to find out? You find out by asking. And once you find out how much they are, send us, please, the equivalent of three drinks, one for the colonel, one for the doctor, and one for me. And people have been very gracious, and thank you very much. And we still haven't done anything with it yet, but I promise you we will tell you the stories, or at least I will, from whatever we do. Like the last time when we got barber shaves, shaves in a barber shop, put on suits, and went to Musso and Frank out here, one of the greatest, oldest restaurant and bars in the whole Hollywood area. And it's really early on. It's from 1918 or 1915 or something like that. And a great true connection is that that's where Wyatt Earp hung out his last 20 years or something like that, when he and his wife lived right here in Hollywood. And that when he went, when he passed away and he was buried here, but that's where he was a big visitor to Musso and Frank. So you know what? That's close enough for me. And so wherever we get, we'll tell you. But thank you. Thank you, Amazon, in advance. We like the relationship. And thank you for going to PayPal and sending us enough for a drink. In any case, we'll let you know what stories come out of that when we can, well, get there. When we can get off our butts and go there. So thanks very much for that. And this actually is a perfect way to get into our joke of the week. That's right. The joke of the week. That's correct. The joke of the week. That's not incorrect. It's right. It's the joke of the week. And it's from, well, a tiny, tiny thing from the great sense of humor of a really great comic who's passed on since he's no longer with us, Myron Cohn. He was, boy, he was just a great joke teller. And when I say joke teller, I mean most comics aren't joke tellers. I like to think we're moving a tiny, tiny bit forward just by, well, getting a chance for, I love to tell a joke a week, a joke of the week. But Myron Cohn, folks, if you haven't seen or heard anything from him, and he's passed on now, what he was, the greatest joke teller I've ever seen. There are some great comics who are great joke tellers, but Myron Cohn was, first of all, he worked in the Garment Center in New York City, and when he would meet with clients, he would always tell a joke first. Now, that's what I think they tell you in sales, in these businesses, tell a joke first. You put everyone at their ease. And what everyone kept telling him, including people in his office, he would tell a joke or two at the sessions that started a meeting with a couple of his clients, whether they were out to lunch or whether they were in a boardroom somewhere. He'd tell a couple of jokes, and everyone always said, you're the greatest joke teller we've ever heard and we've ever seen. You should be a professional comedian. And one of those days, he finally took them at it, and the owner of one of the restaurants that he took people said, you know, you should come here and perform, and you should do these jokes. The guy, he was on the Ed Sullivan Show, I think 28 times, it said in his biography. I saw him when I was a kid on the Ed Sullivan Show. Always loved the guy, and boy, oh boy. And here, here Colonel Jeff went to, on the internet, you punch in the name, and here are a couple of these jokes that I think they're just jokes. They're regular jokes. You could tell them, but to think of the way this man told them, what a joke teller he was. So here are a couple. They're not long jokes, but I think they sure are good. Here's one about, he says, there was a Hollywood producer who was scheduled to marry a starlet he had discovered. Darling, he told her one afternoon, they didn't pick up my contract. I'm finished, out of a job. Worse yet, I'm flat broke. And the starlet says, don't worry, sweetheart. I'll always love you, even if I never see you again. Now, it's not that that's the greatest joke ever written, but Boy, oh boy, it's a pretty good joke. It's got all the parts in place. And to think of Myron Cohn telling that, "I'll always love you, even if I never see you again." It sort of fits whatever mold you were thinking of. But that's one. And here's one. This happened in New York City's Garment Center, coincidentally. One afternoon, the boss was visited by his wife. It was a surprise visit. The boss was a dress manufacturer, so he offered to take his wife for lunch. As they were going down in the elevator, it stopped at the 12th floor, and a shapely model got on. She smiled, pinched the boss's cheek, and kissed him on the lips. "Hello, you little darling cutie pie," she said. Without so much as blinking an eyelash, the wife tapped the model on the shoulder and said, "I'm Mrs. Cutie Pie." Now, that seems to have, to me, that's just a great joke. No one's killing each other. No one's mad. It just sets up a structure. So she's just, well, setting her straight and setting her husband straight, doing something. Is anything bad going on? No, it's just that that's something you say when something like that happens. It's just great. "Hello, you darling little cutie pie. Oh, by the way, I'm Mrs. Cutie Pie." That's a pretty good joke. And here's one more from Myron Cohn. These are they're endless, but here's just one more for today. "Max," the angry wife screamed, "you've gone and done it this time. You're not only a drunken good-for-nothing, you're not only a bum, you're not only a gambler, but you've lost me, the only good maid we ever had." Max, who was a little drunk at the time, said, you know, he was getting a little annoyed. He said, "Well, what did I have to do with the maid leaving?" "You shouted at her over the phone. You used vile, insulting, dirty words." And the husband says, "Oh, my gosh, I'm sorry, honey. I thought all the time I was talking to you." So that's, again, that's not in the style Myron Cohn would have told them. What a wonderful joke teller he was. And I had a chance to meet him when I was a baby comic. And I was working in Cleveland at the Cleveland Comedy Club, and I found out that that Myron Cohn was appearing at a big theater in the Round just outside Cleveland, just a mile or two outside Cleveland. But it was, you know, a couple of thousand people, and it was a big theater. And he had, coming around to Sunday, he had two more shows left, a Sunday afternoon and a Sunday evening show. And I was working that Sunday night, and I said I had met someone in a bar there, and she and I were having breakfast that Sunday, because that's what you do. You meet someone in a bar and say, "How about breakfast tomorrow?" And that's all you need to know. But the point is, I said to her, "You know what, let's do, you have a car, and let's go over, and I'd like to meet Myron Cohn, and go over in between shows and just say hello." And I didn't know the man, and we did that. You know, she drove us over there. It was a lot of fun to be in the car with her, because we had just had breakfast that morning. Why wouldn't it be fun to be in the car with her? Huh? And at any rate, I'm asking you. So at any rate, we got to this theater. I can't remember the name of it, but it was the first show had just ended about a half hour ago. And we walked in the back there, and people were very nice, and they just pointed us to the dressing room. And I walked over, knocked on the door, and he opened it up. What a nice man. What a smile he had. What a just a kind, gracious smile. But he was, talk about old school, he was in the in-between shows outfit of a comedian, well, from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and this was well, what would this have been? This would have been, I guess, 81, 82, something like that. At any rate, though, so he smiled. I said, "Hi, Mr. Conan. I'm a comedian working in Comedy Club." And he was very nice, though. He invited us in and set us down. He was wearing a white bathrobe, not a giant thick one, just a white bathrobe. And he was still just wearing the black dress socks that went up above the calf, but the suit was hung up and the pants were hung up because, after all, in between shows, you don't wear the suit. You got to hang it up again so you look crisp when you walk out for the next show. And plus, it's more comfortable. So if you're going to have a bite to eat or just lie down on a couch or anything at all or watch TV. So he was very nice, very gracious, and just let me say the truth, which was I thought he was the greatest joke teller I had ever heard, and it was a real pleasure to meet him and to be able to say, to think we were in the same business, and that I'd be, if I didn't have to do a show that night, I'd be seeing him there tonight. He was very sweet, very kind. And, you know, we didn't press our, there's nothing to press there. I just said, anyway, we only sat there 5 or 10 minutes. And I just said, I know you want to relax. It's in between shows. And thank you. Just have a great show tonight. And that image of him, though, with that great smile, just a very kind smile, like the nicest grandfather you ever knew. And doubled by the fact that he's the man's in a white bathrobe with his black dress socks going over the calf. And it was awfully nice. And that means something to me in show business, that to have the chance to touch base with someone you really, really respect, the chance in Hollywood to meet great stars you've had a lot of respect for, really means nothing to me. It doesn't mean nothing in the fact that, holy mackerel, you've just met so-and-so. But after, you know, one audition I had, I was going down in the elevator. Oh, golly, this is around the same time. This is 82, 84, 85, something like that. I was going down in the elevator. I'm, you know, all alone, just had an audition. I'm there with the pages still in my hand. And as I turn, there's another guy in the elevator. And I just glanced at him and I realized it was Burt Lancaster. And he was at some meeting or had an office there. And I just... You know, you don't want to annoy people. And he was wearing a cap. And, you know, he, God bless him, he was a great actor. He was a really wonderful, physically fit actor. He was just magnificent. And, oh, so many, I can't even start to just see From Here to Eternity. Well, any of those movies he was in, he was great. But I looked at him and I just, all I could say was, and he looked over at me and smiled. And I just said something simple like, oh, God bless you. That's all. Just, oh, I'm a huge fan. And he smiled. The same thing, though. Such a kind look in his eyes. And he just recognized I was holding the papers, you know, the script. And he just said, audition, eh? You know, something like that. I can't really do impressions. But it did, and I just, yes, I just had the audition, and I know I'll have a nice half-hour ride back to my apartment to think about what I could have done better. And he kind of smiled and chuckled a little. But that was it. We got out. I just said, you know what, just thanks. God bless you. And but the point is to see people you really respect, to see people who are and were great stars, isn't that you've won a lottery. It isn't that you get to call people up and say, guess who I just saw. You may want to do that, by the way, which is fine, but it's that it really has a chance to make even the tiniest connection. Well, when I met Myron Cohn, I had the ability to say the truth, which is, hey, I'm a comic too, and I'm working tonight too, and it's over at another place, but boy, I think you're great. And to meet Burt Reynolds when you still have the sides in your hand, the part of the script you were auditioning with, and for him to know, well, yeah, I'm in show business too, and you wouldn't know me, and I haven't been in anything yet. And but to say, boy, I think you're great, and that really means a lot to me. And that's in a way what leads us to another favorite section of mine now on the show, which is the magic movie moment. And that's right, the magic movie moment, which is a very meaningful part of talking about movies we love. And it just dawned on me, by the way, because I'm so clever, I'm looking at the doctor and the colonel now, and it just dawned on me when picking a movie, it might have been nice and easy to pick a Burt Lancaster movie. Boy, there's an interesting Freudian slip, right? But it would have been logical to pick a Burt Lancaster movie, and there's so many. Oh, brother. I just saw Field of Dreams again just about a week ago, and by golly, that part he played of the doctor who was taken out of the game, never really got a chance to hit, and they go back in time because he's already passed on. Oh, he was so good, Lancaster, in that part where he looks and smiles and says, gotta be getting back home. Alicia's gonna think I got a girl. And, you know, with that smile, and of course he's kidding, but just that kind smile and a kind of a wink of the eye, brother. And I could have picked that movie, but that's not the one I picked. I picked instead, very carefully and very intelligently, if I may say, I picked a movie that Burt Lancaster, God bless him, Burt Lancaster could very easily have been in. Now, he wasn't, as it turns out, so it really has no connection there. But it's a magic movie moment that came into my head this week, and I'll tell you why, because it goes into what's important in life? What do we really do in life? How do you enjoy a Sunday? As I said at the beginning of a show, what do you want to do? Do you want to just lie there in bed all day and have a breakfast in bed and do a crossword puzzle from the paper and watch some TV? Yes, you do. Yes, I do. I think anyone sane does. But I'll tell you what happened in a minute. But the magic movie moment is something that from a movie I always loved and always just really liked so much. It's called Forbidden Planet. It's from 1956, and it has such great actors who were stars in it. It has, when they land, the Dr. Morbius, that's his name. Dr. Morbius is played by the great Walter Pidgeon, a great, great actor. Oh, boy, if you'd ever seen, there's so many movies. Mrs. Miniver is... He's just so good, and he has such a deep, resonant voice, and it's so, he's a handsome guy, but he's like an uncle handsome, or a grandfather handsome. He's just fabulous, and his daughter was played by Anne Francis. His daughter, Altera, I think was the name, and she, remember, this is 1956, so Anne Francis was playing an 18-year-old daughter. And she was probably 18 at that point. And they come on the spaceship. They're on the planet. They're on the Forbidden Planet. The two of them. They're all alone. They've always been all alone on the Forbidden Planet. Going to the Forbidden Planet to rescue them and whatever part of the landing party 20 years ago that landed was still there. That is a spaceship. And the head of the spaceship, the captain, is, well... the great Leslie Nielsen, whom you know from all of the funny, funny movies he made. And at that point in his life, in 1956, he was playing, and he was great playing these parts. He was playing, well, the handsome, dramatic, likable, wantable captain of the ship. So, you know, there are some very handsome other officers in there. Warren Stevens, a great actor, and Jack Kelly, was playing another guy in there, and they were great. And the wonderful Earl Holliman. I always loved that guy. Earl Holliman was in so many great things. I think he was in Sons of Katie Elder as well, and he was in Sharky's Machine. He's been in about 100 movies you love, and he's been great in all of them. And he was in this movie in 1956. And I'm glad because I had a chance to meet him at a car wash about 2 years ago here. There's another story about how it just happens. So you met him at a car wash. It just happens. And I'm lucky because I always have a chance to say, and I mean it when I say it, I said, boy, I think you're great. And suddenly we're talking, and I'm thrilled to talk about him and so many of the parts I've loved. And by the way, he looks great, considering I don't know how old the man is or isn't, but he's not a kid anymore. And I'm telling you, he looked just as great as he did in Forbidden Planet in 1956. And that's just because he's got the Cary Grant gene of, you know, he can work out and you look at him and say, holy mackerel. It's not like, you know, his skin's been pulled. I'm telling you, this guy is a natural. But boy, he was good in this movie. And then, of course, you know, as the movie it should be, when Leslie Nielsen first meets Anne Francis in the movie, and I mean, how smart do you have to be to know, well, they'll wind up together because they're both, well, gorgeous. And they should, and she likes him. He's very nice. He's the captain of a ship. He likes her because she's 18, and she's been on the planet alone forever, which is another part of that movie, by the way, where you say, so you're just alone. And your father, Walter Pidgeon, Dr. Mobius has a lot of old alien books to read, and he can try and figure out how smart they were. And you, well, you have to walk around and say, well, there's another rock. But now that's another reason you get to fall in love with Leslie Nielsen. And the magic movie moment I have in this movie is that with effects from 1956, it really gives you a magical plot point that you buy, that you get into, that you believe. It's, oh, I suppose you could say the tiniest bit Freudian, that Walter Pidgeon, as he explores what the aliens knew on the planet years, hundreds, thousands, millions of years before he got there, and he explores, they knew they were all brilliant, and they began to explore the brilliance of their own minds, but it was dangerous because the more they could get those minds to come to life, the more they could get their own fantasies and images to come to life, and the more Walter Pidgeon's character, Dr. Mobius, did it, what he didn't realize, what they didn't realize, and the reason they were wiped out, and the reason Walter Pidgeon is in so much trouble is because when you make your mind go to those places, and when it can become real, when the characters and spirits in your own mind can come out and get really angry. And who are they going to get angry at? Well, anyone who was there. Another couple there who was on the spaceship. Or, you know, it's just very, it's very, well, it's a deep plot point. And what they did was, I remember this as a kid, and I remember it, I've seen the movie 20, 30 times, and I love it still as an adult. When the monster, you never see him, you hear it in sounds, you hear it in little electronic sounds, and they say, what is this? What do we have to do? What's getting to us? Who's killing us here? And when you finally see the monster, even with older special effects, it's so satisfying to see what looks like in just an outline, an electronic outline, as it goes through a security point at the fence around the spaceship. It's roaring, but it's big. It's about as big as a house, and it's roaring like a lion mixed with a wolf. I don't know. It's not even that clearly drawn, but it's better that way. It's better that it's not clearly drawn, because that's what makes it work, and that's what made that moment magical for me in movies. Because today, if they show you something like this today, they will spend the money and take the time to draw a monster you don't like anyway. And it's a monster that just takes up so much time. It takes up a year, 2 years of people doing research on this and using money to draw a monster. That's fine, but it doesn't look like a monster. It just looks like something they drew instead of something that becomes magical. It's like, to me, like a lot of cartoons today, the best cartoons are still, well, the Warner Brothers cartoons from the 1940s and 1950s. That was a great Bugs Bunny. That was a great Elmer Fudd. That was a great Donald Duck. And those were great. And if you realize that they're just drawn, they were drawn to move frame by frame. So it's not that they're so magically connected, but those were more alive to me than those characters were so alive to me, more so than anything I see today that's really, well, overmade or overdrawn. And that's what was magical to me about Forbidden Planet and the moment that you've all been waiting for, that I was waiting for. It's not the biggest plot point in the movie, but still, the monster is going to emerge. Are they going to beat the monster, or is the monster going to beat them? It's before they realize, it's just as they're about to realize, it's just as Leslie Nielsen is about to realize that the real monster is Walter Pidgeon. It's what he let go. It's a wonderful movie, and it's very, very well done. But when you see that monster just barely drawn in the little electronic points as it's trying to get through, that drawing of that monster and that moment was more real to me, not in being terrified. Sure, you're a little scared, but in saying, wow, look at that. That's what the monster looks like just before he eats you. If you really saw him, it would look a little more real. But just seeing the way they did it, I thought, even as a kid, I thought, good for you guys. Look what you did. And I felt the same thing when I see it, every 4 years or so, I see it somewhere. It's very satisfying with the great actors in it. It's very satisfying with the love story they tell. It's very satisfying with the parent being honest with the child finally and saying what he's done, even though he's not glad of it, even though he wasn't happy about it. And it's very satisfying. Well, I won't, being a spoiler now, I won't do that and tell you what exactly happens. But you know what? It's worth seeing. And you'll know when you do that one magic movie moment is when we first see, and see is in quotes there, we first see the monster that comes from Walter Pidgeon. And it's not something you're going to stop at and say, oh, wait, let's stop and see that again. But I'll bet you think the same thing I do, which is, how do you like what they did in 1956 with the limited funds and the limited time they have? And you know what? All I can say is I hope I meet Earl Holliman at another car wash again. It'd be even better to meet him on a movie set. That would be the sweetest of all. And the question then is, this is why it made me think, what exactly do you want to do with a Sunday? Do you want to see a movie like that? Well, yeah, I do. But what do we do these days that fills our days, especially weekend days? And my wife, whom I love, and she set up a day for Sunday, just this past Sunday. And in the morning, it had three things we were going to do with the kids that all of us would get together and just drive to do. One was, she was the executive producer on a great show called Just Shoot Me. And I like all the writers there, and I like all the actors on that show. And she said, you want to come by? We'll all go down there because they're giving them a plaque on the studio. I think it was Stage 7 on the Radford lot out here, and they're giving them a plaque, and they're going to have a little brunch, and it starts at 11. And so we all went down there, and it was just the right size for an event like that. You know how sometimes you say, I don't want to go to something official because if there's going to be 700 people there, it's going to be just a lot of shouting, and they don't need to talk to me, and I don't need to talk to them. But you know what? This is about perfect because they had about, 20 or 25 people there, and writers I've always liked and known. And, boy, the cast was great. It's just terrific cast. David Spade and so many people. The great Wendy Malick, who's been a friend of ours, and she's just wonderful. And Laura San Giacomo, who is the star of it, a woman so wonderful. I can't tell you what a great soul she has. And just so much fun to see him every time. George Segal, who's such a great actor, was so deep and interesting and powerful in so many movies through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And then, boy, what a laugh he has. And he was in this, and some of the creators of the show and the writers and people I just really like. And, of course, my wife was one of them. And then after that, so they had a big meal for these 25 people to eat. What was the big meal? Bagels and lox. Now, they had, true, you could get an omelet if you wanted. They had a couple of people standing there with the white hats on behind a grill. And, of course, you get one of those. I mean, who am I going to lie to? Myself? To you? If somebody's there and they're going to make an omelet for you and they're going to put everything you want in the world on it, and they had, they must have had, 25 dishes there too with everything in it, with onions and peppers and mushrooms. Oh my. And they had so many things in there. So you get one of those, you have a few bites of that. But mainly, everyone got to, the bagels and lox and cream cheese. And so everyone there is eating bagels and lox and cream cheese. And when we finally left, which wasn't that long, and then they took the plaque off, but you're stuffed with bagels and lox and cream cheese at 1:30 in the afternoon on a Sunday. Get back home. We got back home. It was about 2 o'clock. And my wife had also bought tickets for us online to see 42, the Jackie Robinson movie. And so we went down to the theater to see that with the kids. And then we saw that. And actually saw some friends of ours there, too. That's nice to see an old friend. And I'm not going to say anything about the movie, by the way. You know what? The movie's going to make $1 zillion, and you're going to see the movie. And you know what? You'll tell me what you think. And that it doesn't quite matter. That's not even the point. But you're there. It's 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever it is. And you get through to the end. And as you're walking out, everyone says, what'd you think? Oh, fantastic. Unbelievable. They may not think that, but, you know, everyone, you're going to see it, and you're going to be happy you did. So at any rate, though, we did. We went from there. We got the car again and decided now it's about 6:30 on Sunday. And, we decided to go out to dinner. We could go to a Chinese restaurant nearby us for dinner. And we walked in there. How much time is it going to take? They said about 15 minutes. Which is not too bad. We went down the street, and another one would take 10 minutes. But then they got a table free in the first one in the Chinese restaurant. Hey, they called our name, and they set us down there. Now, this is 6:30, 7 o'clock on a Sunday night in the valley, right on Ventura Boulevard. And this place is jammed. The Chinese restaurant is jammed. And there's a lot of noise in there. And the table they put us was right next to the side room, which is completely open, where there was a birthday party for kids who were, oh, I don't know, heck, they were, you know, 9, 10, 11, something like that. Still young enough to be mixed with girls and boys running around and throwing things. And then there's a table with all the grandparents just sitting, trying to sit quietly. And everyone's eating Chinese food. And, you know, the thing about a Chinese meal, as I think you know, everyone in the restaurant was just pounding down this food. It's just gobs of food, bowls of food. And we finally, we got out of there, I guess, about 7:45 or so, something like that. And we got back in the car, and now we're loaded, still loaded with bagels and lox and now Chinese food and some popcorn at the Jackie Robinson movie. And we got back home, and the point of all this is, and we have a ton of leftovers we took with us back home. And I was thinking the whole day, frankly. I was thinking the whole day, I don't want to be doing any of this. Why can't I sit and lie in bed and read the paper and watch a movie or not watch anything and then take another nap and then figure out I'll make breakfast for everyone the way I always do, but I'll make breakfast for everyone. Why can't I do that and then sit in the living room with nothing on and just read the paper there, do the crossword puzzle there, read the sports page there, and then slowly have a nap? Why can't I do that? Why do I have to do all these things I never would have chosen? And you know what? After a full day out, and I mean a full day, you know, when was the last time you showered and shaved early on a Sunday morning? No need to answer that. I mean, who wants to do that? But after doing that and getting dressed in nice, fancy clothes, well, I call them fancy. You might not call them fancy, but for me, anything that's not jeans is fancy. And putting those on, and then we all piled in the car at 11 and being out the whole day till we got back about 8:30, well, I thought that was a lot to do, and I was just on the edge of being cranky. I could have gotten cranky if I wanted to. I was on the edge. But you know what? Sometimes, happily, thank God you come back from the edge. You don't go over the edge. And what did it for me this time was, well, I walked into the kitchen upstairs, and one of the kids had put the food away, the leftovers from the Chinese restaurant, and one of my other kids had already opened one of the boxes and was eating a piece of chicken out of it with one hand. He was putting a fork in it, and or it was some kind of vegetable thing that was chopped up and put together. And in the other hand, he had a half gallon of milk he was drinking out of, just the half gallon of milk, the way it is in the handbook for every guy. And it's just he was doing the guy drink out of the half gallon of milk. And I saw him do this, 16, and I saw him do it. Now, again, you could see that and say, don't drink out of the thing with the thing, and you know, you put the get a glass, and then you'll have some milk with that. But you know what? Seeing a carton open of leftover food, and seeing a fork go into it, and seeing a half gallon of milk go up to the mouth in one of those long drinks of five or six glugs, big glug, 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 glug. That's a bunch of milk. And then not putting the milk away, and then holding it still for the next glug you want. And you know what? That image, and the other kid was sitting there, had already turned on the computer in the kitchen and was playing one of the Time to Kill Someone games, you know, that they all like. And they do. That's what they do. They like them. They're boys. Maybe girls like them, too. And I looked at that image, and I thought, you know what? If this whole day out with the family and everyone's healthy, and if this whole day, what did it cost? I guess a lot. If you add it all up between the Chinese meal and the price of tickets in a movie and the plaque, so it was probably, I guess, about $200 it would be about to do something like that. So we didn't really buy anything. We didn't get any sneakers. But if you put that all together and what it costs you to not lie in bed, you know what? That one image of one of my kids eating the leftover food with one hand and drinking out of a giant milk container with the other, I thought, that's worth the whole show. That's worth everything. It makes it just as valuable as anything you want. And here we're home again. I could take everything off and wash up and throw on pajamas. And you know what I did? I got into bed the way I wanted to before, but I wouldn't have changed a thing. And that's why it goes to show you, it went to show me that real life, regular life, average Sunday life could still have magic movie moments in it. That shot of him drinking out of that container that I just stood and watched with a smile and then plowing into the leftovers, that was a magic movie moment for me. Just like it was, well, just like it was in Forbidden Planet. So, you know what, folks? It goes to show you, we can have those moments too. So, thank you, and as always, remember, if you walked out of bed today and had a job to go to and a home to come back to and someone there who cares about you, folks, the game's over and you've won. And that is the truth. That is the truth as well as I know it. Thank you for listening. We'll see you here again next week.